even when we can't understand the pain that we have experienced, even when there is no seeming reason or explanation or fruit of that, we can trust that God is working because he delights to work in small and quiet ways, and he delights to bring us into deeper communion with him, and grief offers a unique path toward that kind of intimacy.
Welcome to the Living Wholehearted Podcast, where we help you lead with integrity at home, at work, and in the community.
I'm Tara Mattson, a licensed marriage and family therapist and executive coach.
And I'm Jeff Mattson, an executive coach and organizational development professional.
And together we bring you 2 decades of experience in leader development and trauma-informed therapy. We are so glad you're here to help you become the leader you would follow. So good to have you on the show, Clarissa.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I am really looking forward to this conversation about your new children's book, Hope Comes to Stay. And I want to just start more with your story. At Living Wholehearted, whether we're working with our leaders or someone's going through our professional counseling journey with our team, we really work hard on story work and really helping people understand their story and how it impacts who they are today and often shapes the call on our life and the things that we're most passionate about. So we'd love to just start with your story. I know it's a big question, but maybe a key part of your story that's shaping a lot of who you are and what you're doing in your work.
Sure. Well, I am a remarried widow in a blended family of 9, and it's a busy world. We've got 3 dogs and a cat, so there is never a dull moment. And my life was radically shaped by the loss of my first husband, Rob, in 2019. We were married for 17 years, had 4 biological children, and in the middle of our family vacation, he died in a hiking accident. Police chaplains arrived at my campsite to let me know that he had died. And so the last 6 years have really been a processing of that explosion to the life that we thought we had, learning to live with grief as a companion, not try to push it away or wish it away or run away from it, but really engage with it thoughtfully, to receive the wisdom that comes with grief, to connect more deeply with our faith as a result of that, and then to write a beautiful story forward, to live out the things that we actually believe about resilience and resurrection and the hope that can come even out of a really dark experience.
Yeah, wow. That is a moment that nobody imagines happening in their story. And then find yourself having to really find the pieces and let God kind of bring that all together. So here you are years later. I want to do a podcast just on your blended family there. That's a whole other topic at some point, adjusting to that large of a family and blending a marriage and a family. But for now, this podcast, we'll talk a little bit more about your children's book. So what inspired you to write it's called Hope Comes to Stay, and specifically speaking to children about grief and loss?
Well, it's interesting. Back when I wrote my first book, I really wrote it as an opportunity to pair practical grief support with a gospel-infused perspective on grief and death and dying and loss. It was something that I didn't find on the bookshelves when I was grieving, and I felt like would be really elemental and instrumental for folks who were experiencing the loss of a loved one. But after that book came out, it was pretty clear that there was still a hole. What about teenagers? What about children? There were so many resources that were still needed. And so my teenage daughter and I, my daughter Fiona and I wrote a book called Hurt, Help, Hope for teenagers, specifically designed for them, not for the adults to read in their lives, although we hope that they are reading it as well, but just a very practical tool for teenagers. And so the natural outflowing of that was to say, okay, we have this body of work. We believe that practical grief support paired with a gospel message really does make a difference for people who are bereaved. What does that look like for kids? And what we found when it came to resources for children was that there were a lot of great secular resources, stuff about feelings, being sad, or remembering the person that you had lost. And there were some good Christian resources that talked about things like heaven, but those were abstractions for little kids who were very concrete. And so we thought, well, what if we took the best of what we know about bereavement advocacy and support and paired that with what we know about children developmentally as they are growing in their faith and understanding of God and themselves? What if we put that together in a story, not as a teaching tool per se, but to introduce children to the life of someone who is experiencing those things? You know, when we have little kids, we often schedule play dates for them, and we get the two kids together in the living room, and they don't talk to each other. They sit beside each other on the ground playing with Legos or Matchbox cars or whatever, and we think, well, won't you guys play together? But they are. They're doing what we call parallel play, right? They're learning from one another as they watch the other person, even if it's from a side glance. And really, Hope Comes to Stay offers that kind of parallel play experience for a young child to meet the ideas that surround grieving and death and dying and loss in a story. So I'm not asking a child directly to wrestle with those things. I'm allowing a child to enter into another child's story in this book and watch them wrestle with those things. And we know as a teaching tool for children ages 3 to 8, parallel play, story-based learning, it's a great way to introduce new truths and hard ideas. And we're hoping that that this book serves that purpose for a lot of families.
I love that, Clarissa. For a play therapist perspective, play is to a child that talking is to adults.
And that's right.
Being able to create those kinds of resources and for parents to understand that anytime they can enter into play. So I love that you created the parallel play story in this book. You're speaking about gospel-infused grief and loss, bereavement. You know, in grief and loss, we know there is denial, sadness, anger, bartering, acceptance, meaning. And there's a process that people go through. What do you think are those key elements when you're thinking gospel-infused that you didn't find in some of the resources when you were going through your own loss?
Well, I think one of the things that really informs a lot of bereavement support literature is that the gospel breaks down that idea of process. In the world, we like to think that the hard things we go through, if we just persevere, we'll get to the finish line. There'll be some sort of certificate at the end to say that we checked off all the boxes, we have completed our 7 steps of grieving or 5 steps of grieving, and we are done. Thank you very much. And the gospel just totally blows that idea out of the water, because we know that until Jesus comes again, sorrow will be our companion, that we will be always walking through the stages and the steps, as it were, that there is no finish line in sight that brings us full healing until Jesus comes again. And so in our work, in my work as a writer, in the bereavement advocacy we never use the words healing or recovery, because from a gospel perspective, that will come, but it's not going to come in this lifetime. So we use words like renewal, restoration. We talk about flourishing, because all of those things can happen in the here and now. It requires a lot of work. And for children especially, we know that they will regrieve at every new developmental stage as their understanding of their loss strikes them in a new way. If you've lost a grandma at age 8, you're going to feel differently about that loss when you turn 16 and she's not there to congratulate you on getting your license, when she's not there to stand and take a wedding picture with you at your wedding. You're going to feel that loss differently. And so, you know, the gospel really gives us rich resources to deal with that, so that a child in particular who is experiencing perhaps fresh and raw feelings of grief many years after the inciting incident doesn't think, oh, what's wrong with me? I must be going backwards. I thought I was done with this. Now, the gospel says it's okay. It's okay for it to hurt as long as it hurts, that Jesus will be present with you in that pain, and that he offers you his kingdom in the here and now, even as you wait for its consummation in the days to come.
I love that. You're speaking to really how important it is that we use certain language when we're thinking about being followers of Christ. And it's interesting that the gospel, you know, doesn't give us a quick, fast, easy 1, 2, 3 step, right? We don't see that throughout scripture. And yet Christians often have a hard time. I say people have a hard time grieving well, just because none of us really like pain or feeling, right? We want to numb it out as best we can. But the other side is that Christians and often certain parts of the church really haven't used lament or grief and loss as part of a spiritual formation. And so we get often toxic faith kind of messages of like, well, if you follow Jesus and you'll have a blessed life, well, what does that really mean? And then when loss comes, it can really shatter our sense of who God is and who we are in his kingdom. So speak a little bit about this book and even just the value of being able to integrate loss and this kind of language into our discipleship with our kids.
Well, one of the things that's really interesting about lament, particularly in the Psalms, I think, is that we don't get a lot of connective tissue between the big, angry, hard, frustrated, sad, sorrowful feelings of the psalmist and his statements of trust in God. Usually there's one little word like, therefore, or right, but I will have hope, you know, and as a grieving person, as someone who's struggling or suffering, you think, well, could you show your math a little bit here for me? Psalmist, show me how you got from being so sorrowful to being able to grasp onto God's promises with such tenacity, such hopefulness. And we don't see that happening. What we often see are simply these two things that we must hold in the same hand together without a whole lot of explanation about how to do it, or whether those things need to mesh with one another or coincide or settle with one another. And the great thing about kids is they do this all the time. I mean, every parent has seen a child fall down on the playground, burst into tears, have their knee wiped off, and then suddenly run right back to the slide from which they just fell. It's amazing how kids have this ability innately to hold contradictions together in the same hand. And so when we're talking to kids about lament, it makes a lot of sense to them. Adults feel like they need to see the math problem. They need to see it all work out. But kids are very often willing to experience joy and then experience sadness, and then hop back into joy again. And so really, as we are working with children who have experienced loss, we want to be careful that we don't superimpose our adult conceptions of how we wrestle with hard things onto our children, and really instead become students of that child, become attentive, curious observers, sit at their feet, ask them questions, allow them to take the lead, because there are certainly, children need the adult guidance. They need our wisdom as we shepherd them through hard things. But they also have so many innate God-given resources that I think we can tap more often than perhaps we do when it comes to wrestling with hard stuff.
Well said. And I think the kind of the in-between you're talking about that maybe isn't named here overtly, but is the being present together. I think that's often as we're working backwards in people's stories, going, nobody just was present with you to let you share your wisdom or what you thought about the losses or to just cry and be held. That's often why we see a kid bounce when they're comforted and they're cared for, and then they can go back out a little quicker than us adults because we overanalyze it all and prevent, right?
Yes.
Control our worlds. So, okay, so in your book, you have this surprising new friend. Talk a little bit about the intentionality of the surprising new friend and the part that they play in the book.
Well, I love that you use the word presence, because that is something that stands out in almost every bereavement study of children that I think has ever been conducted. 1 in 14 children in the U.S. will lose a parent before they turn 18. Mm-hmm. And in studies with the New York Life Foundation, which is the largest longitudinal study of children in bereavement that exists in the U.S., children who have lost a loved one identify a couple of things that really make a difference for them. It's people who treat them like they're normal, people who remind them of their loved one in either small or significant ways, and people who stick around. And I think that presence is so vital. And in the story, Leela meets a bear doesn't have a name, and she just kind of takes this bear along with her as she goes. And it is a symbol not only of the presence, the ongoing presence of grief, as Leela moves to school and she goes outside and plays and experiences change over the course of the year, but it's also a reminder that companionship is the vital resource for children who are grieving. You know, from research, we know that children who experience an adverse childhood experience, something like divorce, a loss of a parent, abuse, any of these kind of traumas early in life, they need a lot to be able to cope and thrive again. But there's one deciding factor for them. Do they have at least one trusted adult in their life? And it all boils down to presence and companionship. And so this bear becomes like a symbol for her of the ongoing presence of the love of her father, the ongoing presence of grief in her life, and the connection that really pushes us forward into new life after loss and gives us the wings to fly again.
I love that. I love that intentionality. And for children, they'll pick up on that probably faster than some of us adults who maybe don't realize that's the intentionality of this bear. But presence really is key. And one of the things I keep thinking about is how parents often don't prepare their children for loss until loss happens. So what is your thought on that as you think about maybe a broader sense of preparing our kids for life and life with God and life with hard things? My mentors used to say it this way: we often prepare our children prepare the road for our children rather than preparing our children for the road. And so being able to kind of help our kids be better equipped for loss and grief, even if they haven't had something overt happen. Talk about that and maybe how parents can use this book in that way.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's one you're right, we often want to avoid. Mm-hmm. 10 years before my husband died, he published a book called The Art of Dying. He was a hospice volunteer. He had worked in a funeral home on the night shift because he was a journalist and he wanted to understand more of the ethics of modern dying, euthanasia, you know, questions about death with dignity. And so he had spent a lot of time with dying people, holding their hands on Saturday mornings as he would attend to them, or working with grieving families in the evening as calls would come in to the funeral home or they needed to make arrangements. And so death and dying were a part of our family conversations in an unusual way from very early on. And, you know, I hated that. I want to be clear. We had three little kids at the time running around our ankles. I did not want to talk about death ever. I didn't want to think about him dying, about me dying, about one of my children, God forbid, dying. I wanted to imagine that nothing bad would ever happen to this beautiful family we had created. But what I realize now is that as he processed those hospice visits, as he came home, as he insisted that we talk about wills and advance directives, all of these things that in our early 30s, we never thought we would need until we were old, what a gift of love that became to me and to our children after his dying. And so when I think about talking to children about death and dying, I think about it as giving them a gift, giving them the language so that they're not fumbling for words, helping them to understand the concrete realities that come with death and dying, whether that's talking to them about roadkill on the road or how the autumn leaves crunch up and die and turn brown in the fall, from an elemental perspective to the higher level things like, what is cremation? Can grandma breathe underground after we've visited her at the cemetery? You know, these kinds of questions are so foundational. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that those conversations happen best in the safety and comfort of your family. We don't want our kids learning from their peers about sexuality and drugs and other big things in life. We want to have those conversations first at home, and we want to do the same with our kids about death and dying. And the reality is, we can't shield them anymore. whether that is because of news, like tragic school shootings, whether that is rising rates of suicidality in young people, whether that's violent video games, and conversations we need to have around the differences between entertainment and real loss. We can't shield our kids, and so it behooves us to begin young, to really give them that gift of love from a very early age, knowing that the foundational conversations we have when they're little, we're going to build on those as time goes by, adding complexity and nuance and really forming a trusting relationship with our kids that says, when the hard time eventually hits, you can come back to me because you know we've talked honestly about this stuff in the past. And you know my heart for you, you know I'm going to be here for you. And those are really, those are the people that a child needs around them when loss does darken their doorstep.
Yeah, you're speaking very much to why we created another organization we run. It's called Courageous Girls. And it is in these intentional conversations to walk with a daughter at every stage. Yes, there is not one for boys. That's a common first question. But the same principles apply to your sons in many ways, unless we're talking specific about body change. But when it comes to these kinds of intentional conversations, just having a guide. And so I love that your book is available to help parents just, yeah, to cuddle up, snuggle up on the couch, to read this as a part of just our daily rhythms and understanding that loss is everywhere. And little did you know, I'm tearing up as I was listening to you talk about your husband and just the way that God prepared you guys in those conversations. You didn't want to have them, but he was faced with death on a regular basis in his work. And so in your own story of losing him and walking with your kids through loss, what were some of the key principles that you learned in your journey about grieving and loss, especially with a gospel-infused vision?
I think the first thing that comes to mind immediately is that there is no sadness that scares away Jesus. I think there are many times where in the normal warp and woof of my life before loss darkened my doorstep, I sort of felt like I needed to clean up a little bit for Jesus, almost like you might clean up your house, tidy it before the maid arrived. If you were hiring a cleaning service, you're sort of embarrassed
the maid,
about.
No, I love that.
Embarrassed about that. You know, I can let my close friends in, but if I was going to have somebody fancy arrive or someone, I don't want them to see how dirty it is, right?
Right.
And I think we often approach the Lord like that. That, well, you know, maybe this thing is just too big. Maybe this thing is just too messy. Maybe my feelings are too angry for God to know what to do with. And I found the expansiveness of God's love to be more than I imagined as I faced my grief with honesty. And so that was a tremendous gift to me. And as a parent, then parenting alone, it allowed me to do the necessary and healthy compartmentalization that's required of a parent who is grieving alongside of a child. You know, I had to learn pretty quickly that there were certain things my kids needed to know or wanted to know, and I needed to discern what was appropriate. I needed to become a gatekeeper for information and even for my own emotional expression in ways that I had never really considered before. And so to know that, hey, you know what? That's putting too much on a kid's shoulders, but it's not too much for the shoulders of Jesus. What a relief to know that there was always someone that I could turn to who would listen, who would empathize as the man of sorrows and deeply acquainted with grief, who could understand the isolation that came with loss, that I didn't have to sort of turn to my children in unhealthy ways and ask them to fill those spots for me. I think the other thing that comes to mind is the beauty of the church to rise up and be the community that grieving people need. You know, so many people I talk to who have experienced the loss of a loved one say, I feel so lonely. My friends are ghosting me. Nobody returns my texts. They've stopped inviting me to things. I feel like I lost everybody. And statistics tell us that 75% of widows eventually leave the church that they had attended with their husbands because they just don't feel like they belong anymore. There is a radical reorientation of identity that comes with grief, and it's often a very lonely process. And there, the church stands as this group of people who says, hey, we're all wounded in some way. You know, if we all showed up to church because we were carrying something hard, we'd all be wearing mourning black. And what a welcome to a grieving person if a church is ready to step up in that capacity, to be the kind of community that says we don't have to have it perfect. We can show up with our woundedness. We will carry each other like the friends do and drop their friend down through the roof to meet with Jesus to be healed. They are the agents of community resilience and restoration for a grieving person. And I know that, you know, in much of secular bereavement support, they talk about finding new communities. And with the church, we have that community already established. We just need to tap into it.
So good. 75%. That is a huge percentage. And, you know, my trauma hat goes, I wonder if that's somewhat related to just the triggers of all those memories. And sometimes some of those women really do need a fresh start. Mm-hmm. And how much of it is that community doesn't know how to come alongside and grieve. So it can be a mix of both.
Yeah.
But how much would you ask the church to lean in, and how much would you ask the person who's grieving to ask for help? I'm curious what your thought is on that, knowing your own journey.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's very hard for a wounded person to be an educator at the same time. And so that's where conversations in advance are the very best conversations to have. So if your church is blessed enough not to have anyone who's currently on their deathbed, all right, engage. Now is the time. Develop a plan. How are we going to come around a person? What resources are we going to have available to them? What is our plan for activation? Because even if a grieving person says, no, I don't need that. I don't need that. I don't need that. They may say that now, but 6 months from now, they may be ready to receive your help. Maybe the fog of grief has lifted and they're feeling the intense pain, like coming off of Novocaine after you've had a root canal. They're starting to feel it really intensely and now they need it more. Maybe they've just needed time to let the dust settle a little bit before they could receive. But either way, having a plan in advance is always your best bet. And then I think what it does for the person who is grieving is it allows them to simply arrive as they are. You know, one of the hardest questions for a grieving person to answer is, how can I help? Right. And so I always encourage folks, you know, if you are a helper, just volunteer. Hey, can I come clean your bathroom? Do you need paper plates? I know you probably aren't doing a whole lot of dishes these days. Do you need me to pick up your dry cleaning? I'm running to the grocery store. Could I grab a gallon of milk for you and just drop it off on your doorstep? Being proactive allows the grieving person to do the simple yes or no. Mm-hmm. And you think of when you show up at an emergency room to the triage, often they'll say, what is your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? There aren't a whole lot of questions because a person in pain can't answer a lot of questions. And so that 1 to 10 scale is really helpful. And in the same way, being able to offer suggestions where a grieving person can just say yes or no is really, really helpful, particularly in the early stages of grief. Mm-hmm. Now, that'll change and shift and grow according to the relationships you develop with that person. But I think in as much as we can relieve the grieving person of being an educator and a guide through their own experience, we are helping them. It's kind of like preparing a buffet and just saying, come and eat whatever you want, whatever you're hungry for.
That's so good. Well said, Clarissa. Okay. So you spoke a little bit about that really the tension of grieving ourselves while also trying to hold the grief of our children. And it's messy and hard. And so what are some of the tips that you would encourage parents on how to navigate that tension where both parent and child can grieve and appropriately attend to a child, but also attend to yourself?
The interesting thing about children is that when times are good, their personalities are a particular way. And when times are bad, that same personality still shows up. And so your child does not transform into a different person after they have lost a loved one. They're still the same person. They're going to manifest perhaps some of their personality quirks and traits in different ways, but the quiet person will probably still be quiet. The active child will probably still be active. And that will shift and change, but these are all within the range of normal for children. And so really it's applying very similar kinds of communication skills and techniques, being attentive to their needs in the similar ways that you had before, and watching for changes. I think we come to grieving children expecting a lot of change and are sometimes surprised to see that they're very much the same as they were before. And so, you know, I often will remind parents that grief research tells us there are often two kinds of grievers. There are instrumental grievers, kids who they want to go and kick a soccer ball around, or they go to art class and they paint a picture of grandpa. They need to do something with their bodies to express their grief. And they may never cry at all. And that's totally normal for them because they're working out their grief in ways that feel most natural and comfortable for them. And then there are intuitive grievers, kids who need a good cry. They want to snuggle. They want to talk through some big feelings with you. They may never take out their frustrations on a soccer ball or never paint a picture, but they're also grieving in ways that are appropriate for them. And many kids are a mixture of both of those things. And so really it's just providing the space for a child to grieve in the way that feels most comfortable for them. And then watching for those warning signs that we know in a host of issues signal difficulties, prolonged dietary changes, prolonged sleeping changes, prolonged behavioral changes. You know, all of those things are natural and normal for children as they're coping with loss. But it's when we start to see those red flags of, oh, this has been going on for a really long time. That's when you may want to pull in some other advisors and wise helpers to assist you.
Yeah, when you say prolonged, often the question I get is, what is prolonged? Like, how long is too long? And so I'm going to ask you, what would you say is prolonged versus the appropriate grieving process that's kind of just there's normal with quotations if you're not watching me?
Yeah, I don't think that there is a particular calendar date or timestamp that you can put on it. And that is what is challenging. And that's where the relational dimension of grief support is so vital. When I am present with a person, I notice changes far more than when I only pay attention to them or only see them incidentally. And so when I'm with someone in the regular rhythms of our day, when I'm really paying attention to that person, I notice the things that are subtle changes or that are big changes. I can start to count the days. And so part of it is the relational piece of it. The other piece of it is creating a circle of support for your child, because a lot of parents don't notice things because they're not manifesting at home. And at first, when I was first a grieving parent, I thought, oh no, this isn't good. My kid won't tell me this, until I realized he or she had told something to the coach or he or she had told something to the teacher. And I thought, wow, this is wonderful. I'm not alone in caring for my child. If she doesn't want to talk to me, that's okay. She's got another trusted adult that is in her life that she feels comfortable talking to. And so that's where not only the presence and intentionality of a parent is helpful in determining that time frame, but also a circle of support where teachers are checking in with you saying, hey, you know, I know she's coming unwound at school, but she's holding it together really well, or she's expressing herself really well at school. I think things are moving in a positive trajectory. To have that kind of community support as a sounding board for you and also as support for your child is really vital.
Yeah. And so key message is you're saying, don't do this alone. Do this alone. And
that's right.
Heavily into your people that were probably already there before the significant loss has happened. So teachers, coaches, your church, your friends, your family. And And when you are really alone, when you're feeling pretty isolated, it would be okay to, that's when like professional counselors or being able to even ask a local, maybe you're not a part of a church, you can ask a local church. There are resources often in the community. But I would love to just end thinking about the bigger picture of helping our kids and us adults with emotional resiliency. And I love that you speak about that quite a bit in your own books and in yours, particularly thinking about this children's book. What is the role that emotional resiliency plays when, and then how can parents be really intentional about developing this in their children?
I think for people of faith, there are two separate categories here. There is, we can talk about resilience, and then we talk about resurrection. When it comes to resilience, there's a lot of sort of myth in American culture of like, oh, kids are so resilient. Well, they're not, no one is innately resilient. We develop the skills for resilience. And so we teach our children those things from a very early age. And so part of what we're doing with children as they experience loss is teaching them coping skills that build resilience. And there's so much great work around this by a gentleman named George Bonanno, who has done a lot of research around resilience after loss, out of Columbia University. And he talks about the other side of sadness, that there is a space where we move beyond survival to thriving again. And those skills are teachable. And I think that is such a gift for those of us who feel disempowered by grief, who feel like we have lost our agency, lost control. No, there are skills that you can learn. You can learn with your child to build resilience because we have that capacity in our DNA. We work out and muscles break down and they rebuild again. So we've got this capacity. God has given us this brain plasticity in our muscles. We can rebuild if we apply skills to do so. But there's one thing we can't do for ourselves, and that is resurrect. We cannot come back to life again. And that's only something that God can do, right? And so when we talk about resilience, our goal is never to bring myself back to life again, because then we're pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. We are setting ourselves up for a goal that we genuinely cannot attain. And it's where the discouragement around grief sets in. It's where chronic grief begins to set in, a sense of just spinning my wheels in the mud and the muck of loss. And so always when we have conversations about building resilience, we want to say, yes, we want to learn these skills together. We want to learn how to pick ourselves up and keep moving. And we also want to remember that in our weakness, God is found to be most powerful. And why is that? Because he has a resurrection power that we can tap into, that we don't possess on our own. And when those days come where you've done all the skills toward resilience and you still feel like you're slogging through, we have this promise of resurrection, both in the here and now and yet to come, that says, this is the hope that I actually set my eyes on, that unchanging anchor for the soul. It's not that I can do this out of my best effort, but it's that in my best effort, God is working in me to bring me to life again. And so I think for the Christian, it's a great comfort to be able to step into resilience and take that risk, because we do it arm in arm with Jesus.
I love it. There's that both and again, right?
It's that's right.
He's given us, and part of healing on any level of whatever we're working through, renewal, I should use that word instead, is this engaging with restored power. Because often when things happen to us, we feel powerless and we feel stripped of that power. So the resiliency, the muscles, we can learn those. And that's so encouraging and a reminder. And then also there's just a work that only God can do as we lean into him. And he's in us, he's for us, he's before us, he's gone behind us, and he's wrapping around us. And so thank you for the hope that you bring, even in just all the loss and the reality that this life can be so hard and yet so good. And I love this children's book. It really feels like more of a resource for sure with parents and families that are going through significant loss, but also for parents to think about discipleship a little bit more holistically and really preparing our children for life and being able to lean in and be that present person, that trusted person before really hard things could happen and do happen. So thank you, Clarissa, for being so real about your own life, but also providing these amazing resources for the greater community. Leave our listeners with maybe one last word of encouragement, something that just feels a prompting on your own heart and mind as you think about someone who might be listening even today.
You know, grief causes us to be really self-protective. We don't ever want to get hurt again in the ways that we have been hurt in the past. And as a Christian, I feel that impulse. As a human, I feel that impulse. And one of the things that I have prayed over and over is, God, let grief break me open. Instead of calcify me, instead of harden me, let it break my heart open so that my heart is broken for the things that break your heart. And I think if there is any hidden gift in grief, it's that it reorders our priorities. It changes our values. It opens our eyes to see a hurting world in which we really can be agents of God's restorative and redeeming power. And so, you know, that is in no way to sugarcoat the experiences of loss. It's just to say that in God's economy, nothing is wasted. And that even when we can't understand the pain that we have experienced, even when there is no seeming reason or explanation or fruit of that, we can trust that God is working because he delights to work in small and quiet ways. And he delights to bring us into deeper communion with him. And grief offers a unique path toward that kind of intimacy.
Thank you. Well, Clarissa Mall, her new children's book, When Hope Comes to Stay, or Hope Comes to Stay. Why don't you tell our listeners how to find you and all your resources?
Sure. You can reach me at clarissamall.com. It's where there's information about my books. I also am on the bulletin every week. You could search that up in your podcast app and hear the work that I'm doing over there. I love to connect with listeners and readers and hear your stories. It's always an awesome honor to be able to walk with grieving people to hope.
Thank you again. So good to be with you today.
Thanks.
And if you are currently going through any grief or loss, or you're walking through with your children, or you need some parent coaching, we've got an amazing team at Living Wholehearted. Reach out to livingwholehearted.com. You can enter on a form or you can call, but we've got professional counselors that can walk with you at every stage that you're working through. And until the next time, continue to grow and becoming the leader that you would follow.
Well, did you know that we're not just podcasters? One of the best ways to connect with Tara and I and our whole team at Living Wholehearted is our website, livingwholehearted.com. There you're going to find the books that we've written, our e-courses, executive coaching, organizational development, and professional counseling services. And then one of our favorite things that we're up to these days, our Wholehearted Leadership Cohorts, where we take groups of leaders for 1 to 2 year journeys together. It's amazing. While you're there, for fresh content, make sure that you sign up for our e-newsletter. That's where we're putting out stuff every month that you want to keep close with. So visit livingwholehearted.com.
You can also join us on socials at @living_wholehearted on Instagram, and we are Living Wholehearted on Facebook. You can also follow me at Tara Mattson on Instagram. We love to engage with you personally there, so make sure you reach out. Leave us a review if you're enjoying this podcast. And if you're a mom of a daughter, check out our nonprofit, Courageous Girls, at mycourageousgirls.com, where you're going to learn about biblical, clinical, and relational wisdom, where it's helping you walk with your daughter at every stage of her growing years, helping her to be courageous and confident in a day such as this.
Hey, thank you for caring about being the kind of person and leader that lives with integrity.